It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. We begin today with WNYC Health and Science Editor Sikhan Akpan, who has done such great reporting himself and led others in our newsroom who have reported on health and science in the pandemic. We'll touch on a few developments in the news with Sikhan. One is the new finding from the National Institutes of Health that if you got the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, you're better off getting a different type of booster, the Pfizer or Moderna. But if you got Pfizer or Moderna, looks like they're saying stick with what you got originally for your third dose. We'll get into that. Another piece of vaccine news that we haven't touched on yet on this show is the amazing history-changing news that after 100 years of trying, there is now a vaccine for malaria. Now, we hardly have any malaria in this country, so maybe you don't even think about it. But for some other countries, mostly in Africa, this is expected to add up to hundreds of thousands of lives saved a year, mostly children, in fact, who are most susceptible to malaria's worst effects. And then there's the COVID treatment news we also haven't discussed yet. The pill from Merck that they're saying could cut COVID deaths in half for certain vulnerable people. You know, when we talk about science these days, it's so often the politics of science or William Shatner going into space. But science itself, if it's used for good, is so incredible to talk about in its own right. So with me now is WNYC Health and Science Editor Sikhan Akpan. We'll also touch on his investigation into the New York City public schools not being transparent about how much COVID there is in the classroom. Hey, Sikhan, thanks for coming on the show today.
Hey, thanks for having me, as always.
And let's start with this booster shot study from the NIH. People who got the Johnson & Johnson originally are best off with a Pfizer or Moderna booster?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, this was a study that was sponsored by the National Institutes of Health. It involved about 458, involved exactly 458 volunteers split across 9 different groups, so about 50 people for each group. And what's very interesting about it is that the booster vaccines did seem to increase the body's ability to neutralize virus mainly through antibodies. So It increased that by like 4.2 to 76 fold. You know, mixing and matching the vaccines increased that protection by 6.2 to 76 fold. You're right, Johnson & Johnson with Moderna, you know, hitting somebody with J&J first and then Moderna second improved things by 76-fold, and that was the biggest increase in neutralization that they saw. And then the second biggest bump happened after following J&J with Pfizer, and that improved things about 35-fold.
Do they know why that's the case? Why switching from one for the original dose to the others for the booster increases the effectiveness?
You know, I don't think it's totally clear at the moment, but, you know, if we were going to speculate, as everyone probably knows by now, the Pfizer Moderna vaccines are based off of genetic material called messenger RNA or mRNA. You know, it's a cousin of DNA. Mm-hmm. And we've known for a few decades that mRNA is pretty good at stimulating the immune system. You know, the J&J vaccine is based off of different biotechnology, and while it provides solid protection, it has always been a little bit wimpier than the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. So if you remember back to last year, early this year, the clinical trials showed that 2 shots of Pfizer and Moderna, you know, lowered the chances of moderate and severe COVID by about 95%. Johnson & Johnson, it lowered things by 72%. And 86% against moderate and severe disease. You know, part of that could also be because Johnson & Johnson is one shot, and that's actually why the FDA, one of its advisory panels, is reviewing an application for a booster today. Like, J&J is really adding that booster so that way it can boost its protection up to that 95% level that we're seeing with the mRNA vaccines.
Did they test the reverse, a J&J booster in original Pfizer or Moderna recipients, to see if that difference helped boost immunity, that sort of variety of protection?
They did, but, you know, J&J didn't offer much in terms of a boost relative to the reverse situation where Pfizer, Moderna were given to Johnson & Johnson recipients.
Yeah, and from what I read, this study has not yet been peer-reviewed, but still the National Institutes of Health is publicizing it. So can you bestow a little health and science editor education on us and remind us what peer review is and say whether you think it matters in this case?
Yeah, exactly. You know, this study is in preprint form, and the number one thing everyone should remember about preprints is that they aren't final and that the results might change. So it's kind of funny. You know, for example, this study is looking at three different time points, you know, 1 day after a person receives a booster, 15 days after a person receives a booster, and 29 days after a person receives a booster. And at the moment, they haven't finished all of the 29-day observations. And if you look in the chart in the preprint, it literally says in process in the chart. So I think we should, you know, sort of wait and see the final results. And also we should keep in mind that this study is fairly small, you know, 50 people per group. You know, how is that going to compare and translate to the entire nation, right? or the millions of people who might want to get these booster shots.
So this, I guess, brings us to a way into the malaria vaccine story. Like if the COVID vaccine was developed through Operation Warp Speed, the malaria vaccine has been like Operation Turtle and Sloth. Why did this, which is so central to global public health, even if people aren't aware of it much in this country, take a century while they were able to create a COVID vaccine in months?
Yeah, you know, the malaria vaccine that was finally authorized by the World Health Organization, it's called RTSS vaccine. You know, it was first created in 1986, so it's a very long time ago, actually, the same year I was born. And yeah, you know, malaria causes hundreds of thousands of deaths every single year. You know, we're talking about 200 million cases every single year. And I think that if with COVID-19, we knew that, okay, this is striking the entire globe and it's striking them right now. And so that's billions and billions of people. I think that will always be like a pretty attractive incentive to drug companies to develop a drug to stop that pandemic. You know, I think they want to fight the disease and they have altruistic motivations, but I think, you know, the market forces kind of push companies to all dive into getting a COVID-19 vaccine, maybe not in the same way that we've seen support for the malaria vaccine. And if you look at how the malaria vaccine was funded, you know, like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, you know, through a lot of nonprofits in terms of actually doing the field clinical trials. That just is your answer for why it would take so long. It really just comes down to charity.
Well, if it's mostly poor countries that have a lot of malaria, do you know if there will be the appropriate widespread dissemination of this vaccine or who will pay for that?
That's the hope, because without widespread dissemination, it'll be a bit hard for this vaccine to cut malaria rates. So if you look at the efficacy, we're talking it's sort of in the 30 to 40% range. You know, that can cut tens of thousands of deaths and, you know, probably hundreds of thousands of cases every single year. But without a widespread rollout that's well-funded, that can get these shots. And so we're talking about four shots for this vaccine. You know, if you think it's hard to roll out two shots and now three shots of the COVID-19 vaccines, like just imagine trying to roll out four shots. You know, there is going to have to be a huge, I think, humanitarian lift to make sure that these vaccines get to everyone that needs them.
Another scientific breakthrough in the news, Merck's COVID treatment pill. When they say it can cut COVID deaths and hospitalizations in half, this is the headline everybody's been hearing, cut them in half. Is it clear what that actually refers to, Sikon, like cut it in half among who or in what circumstances?
Yeah, so not really. I mean, I think, you know, akin to the NIH study that we mentioned at the top, that's a preprint. You know, we have even less information about this Merck drug right now, so all we have right now is a press release. You know, we don't know very much about the individual subjects. We know that there were 775 adults, but we don't know, you know, what are the demographics there? Are they black, white, brown? We also know that the subjects were at a higher risk for severe disease due to like pre-existing conditions. But we need a lot more information to be able to discern exactly how this is going to impact a large population. But, you know, they did see a 50% reduction in hospitalizations, or they reported a 50% reduction in hospitalizations. I think we need to see the data before we can fully validate that takeaway. Yeah. But so it could be big.
Well, are there indications at this point how this compares to the monoclonal antibody treatment that people can also get early on to help prevent serious effects? That's more complicated to administer than taking pills. It's IV. Is it clear yet, assuming availability of both, how doctors should use these options?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I think people are excited because it's a pill. You can just pop it in your mouth and hopefully it will reduce your chances of hospitalization by 50%. With the monoclonal antibodies, yeah, it takes a little more work. You have to go to an outpatient facility, or you have to have a clinician visit you at home to administer that IV. But it reduces the odds of hospitalization by 70 to 85%. So, you know, it's a bit better than what we're seeing with this pill. And then, you know, I think if you consider the vaccines, which, you know, in the case of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are still reducing hospitalization by, 90%, 85%, even in the face of Delta, it'll be interesting to see where exactly this Merck pill shakes out. But yeah, we don't know much about, you know, can you take the pill and get monoclonal antibodies right now? Just because we don't know much about what what exactly Merck found with this pill.
We have a few minutes left with WNYC Health and Science Editor Sikhan Akpan as we talk about various really interesting and important science things in the news. Let me touch on the investigative report that you did on lack of transparency about COVID in New York City schools. Who's not telling us what?
Yeah, you know, we've been digging into COVID outbreaks in New York City schools. We had a few reports about ventilation and the ventilation preparations for New York City schools. And then we had one about an outbreak at a school in East New York where, it wasn't an outbreak. Essentially, a couple of days before school started, the whole staff at this school got together, and then there was a COVID exposure. Somebody tested positive after the fact, and then the school had to quarantine about a third of their staff the night before school started. The thing is that they didn't tell parents. And so, you know, that story was really just about what the Department of Education tells parents and what they don't tell parents in an emergency situation like that. You know, we're going to have a follow-up in the coming days looking at ventilation in schools. And I think what would be nice is that if the Department of Education would share sort of like basic information about COVID in schools, like directly on the webpage that everybody goes to check what's happening. You know, right now they show classroom closures, partial classroom closures, but that really doesn't tell you exactly how many cases are happening in individual schools. You know, to do that, you have to go to a separate database that's run by the state. You can only look up one school at a time. And, you know, we're hearing from parents, we're hearing from teachers that they're really concerned and they really want to know exactly what's happening in their schools. And they want to know what's happening in the next classroom. And I just think that leaving this mental gap of uncertainty for everybody probably causes more problems than it fixes. And that it would just be better if they just
told everybody everything. Well, yeah, I
exactly.
Get it. If they've just told everybody everything. But for context, isn't it fair to say that outbreaks in the New York City public schools have been minimal so far?
So I don't know if I would say that. You know, I think we're well over 4,000 cases right now in schools. And if you look at the case rates across the city, 13 to 17 year olds are leading the way right now. We're seeing also pretty high rates among kids that are 5 to 12. And so I think minimal is also relative, right? If your school is having more outbreaks than other schools, then you're going to want to know about it.
And some NYU professors, I see, are measuring carbon dioxide levels in classrooms there as a marker of conditions that could also allow COVID aerosols to remain in the air. Preliminary findings show more carbon dioxide than expected, according to the Washington Square News report on this. Some faculty there are concerned that their mandatory in-person policy is not sufficiently safe. Give us a little glimpse into the science of this. Do you know why measuring carbon dioxide would be a good stand-in for the potential presence of COVID?
Right. So when we breathe in and then we breathe out, we take in oxygen and then we let out carbon dioxide. So measuring carbon dioxide can, after, a class ends, can sort of give you an idea of how good the ventilation was during that class, right? Because if you have a room full of people and they're all breathing out, if you have really high carbon dioxide levels, that tells you that the room wasn't well ventilated. I think the other really good measure is airflow. It's a little trickier because you actually have to measure the air moving around the room, and it involves like measuring pressure outside the room and outside the building. I think carbon dioxide levels are sort of becoming a pretty standard way to check on the levels of ventilation in a room. And I think I even saw a story in the New York Times that parents are giving their kids little carbon dioxide meters, and they're sneaking them into their classrooms to check on the ventilation in their classrooms. Yeah, because that's the other thing too. The Department of Education doesn't report the exact airflow ventilation rates in each classroom. It just sort of gives them a green check mark and says that they're good to go.
They used to sneak candy bars into school. Now it's carbon dioxide meters. finally, last thing for today, Sikhan, I know you're interested in space. Did anything scientifically meaningful come out of William Shatner's trip to space, to where no 90-year-old has gone before? Or was it mostly a publicity stunt for Jeff Bezos's space travel company?
Yeah, I think it was the latter, but it was definitely a moment to set phasers to stunned, I might say. I was very moved to see William Shatner, land yesterday. Like, he was obviously overwhelmed. I think as funny as it might sound, Star Trek has had a pretty strong influence over scientific exploration with regards to space. I was almost brought to tears when I heard his clip this morning. Yeah. But for sure, it is a bit of a publicity stunt. I think Blue Origin is obviously a little bit behind SpaceX when it comes to the commercialization of space. There's people make the argument that space travel right now feels like an elite activity. Only the rich will be able to do it. I think, space travel to some degree has always been that way. It's always been like a very, very small percentage of people are going to be able to do it, and I think that's true of the early days of space travel, that was public. And now I think we're starting to see a repeat of that with private space travel.
Yeah, I thought William Shatner was really moving, too, in the interview that I saw with him, where he was comparing the lifelessness of space once you're outside the Earth's atmosphere with all the life that he saw looking down on Earth and imagined taking place, all the people or all the organisms, that the Earth is a ball of life compared to the nothingness of space. That really was a very moving perception. And I guess if he wanted to, he could have also told the anti-vaxxers that he could tell from up there that the Earth is round. So, WNYC Health and Science Editor Seekon Akpan, always great to have you on the show. Always learn from your broad interest in health and science. It's not every news organization that has a PhD in immunobiology leading our coverage of the pandemic. So thank you for everything you bring to the station and to the show when you come on with us. Thanks a lot, Seekon.
Yeah, thanks as always for having me.